The following podcast contains explicit language.
Previously on Empire on Blood.
Everything was on the news. It was in the papers. All because of that one corner.
Cases on today for the court's ruling.
State of New York versus Alan Duarte.
Did you tell anybody about it before Alan Caron offered you a get out of jail card?
In the fight against crime, it's a dirty game.
I mean, Dwight was a gift.
Dwight is an emphatical liar.
You're telling me it's okay for you to kill my family if you had to, but telling is forbidden. Who made that rule?
It's 2003, and Dwight Robinson is in his sixth year as a guest of the New York State Department of Corrections. He's just been transferred to Clinton Correctional Facility, where he spots someone he knows.
I walk in the mess hall, and I'm just looking. I see him. He was already sitting down. I look. I saw him. He turned, and he saw me. He was like, oh, what's up? And I remember he was with a dude that was real close to him, and he actually said, yo, that's my little brother right there. And it was like, what's up? You all right? He was like, you know, typical Cal.
Cal? The man Dwight helped convict of a double homicide? After Cal went away, Dwight caught a body, as they say, and now he's doing 25 to life for murder. So Dwight and Cal find themselves in the same prison mess hall. I've interviewed plenty of prosecutors and detectives, and they all say this should never happen. A cooperating witness and the inmate he helped put away, they should never meet.
He said, I'm always good. You need anything? I said, I'm good. He said, I'm going to see you in New York.
So Cal and Dwight meet later in the yard, where on nice days, inmates play basketball and lift weights. It's November. It's cold. Cal and Dwight sit on a bench, both in green prison uniforms. Cal may seem cool to Dwight, but really, Cal is wary. He's wary of the man who not only snitched on him, but who once shot him.
He could knife me down in the yard. You understand? It's the same guy that just tried to kill me. You know, for me, it's like, why? I didn't try to hurt you. I didn't try to do nothing to you. As in fact, that I wanted for you what I want for myself. I never tried to cheat you. I wanted just to hear him out. And why? You know, that's what I did. I listened more so than anything. I don't show no anger, man.
For Dwight, seeing Cal in the yard is like time travel. They'd once been brothers in the crack trade. Back then, Dwight loved being close to Cal. Maybe, Dwight thought, this is a chance to start all over again.
Well, he had a saying. Miscommunication brings misunderstanding. And we never communicate. The only thing we did was let our guns talk. So he felt like if we had just sat down and spoke about things, maybe everything would have worked out different. You know? And I kind of agree with that because, again, a lot of the things that we was going through was mental. Basically, we put a lot of things on the table at that point. We was more mature. We looked at life different. And I guess we both knew what we had and lost. So it was just like from a more mature angle.
More mature, well, yeah, they're older now. Both Cal and Dwight went to prison in their early 20s. Now they're adults trying to figure out the past and a way forward.
Like I was bracing myself possibly for the worst, for there been some type of confrontation or whatever, and watching his hands and stuff like that.
And he was like, I see that you're a thinker. So, you know, we was kicking it in the yard and he was like, steel, sharpen steel. Steel, sharpen steel. Great minds think alike. And
that's what he said.
Yeah. But he didn't add, they just said steel, sharpen steel, but I know what he meant.
Cal remembers Dwight got emotional.
He started breaking down to me. You know, not boo-hoo crying, but tears started to come to his eyes. Where, you know, he's like, Cal, I'm on the inside. This is what I never forget, what he said to me. He said, Cal, I'm on the inside looking out now. Your hand don't call for this. You know what I'm saying? Whatever I have to do, I'm gonna do the right thing to make sure you get out here. You in here for something you ain't do. You know what I'm saying? He's like, if I didn't do what I did, I think everything would have been different.
Jail is a strange place. At the end of the day, we went at each other. But guess what? I know you. You know me. These thousands of guys around us don't know us. It's a comfort there that I know you. You see what I'm saying? We're in a war zone. I might be cool with these guys that I met in jail, but I know you.
And then it happens. Cal reassumes his role as Dwight's big brother, a protector and true friend. Dwight points out an inmate he has a beef with. Cal, according to Dwight, Cal says, I should slap the shit out of him. In other words, I'm going to take care of you, Dwight. Once again, Dwight is in Cal's thrall. Soon enough, Cal tells me, Dwight has a confession to make about the Harris brothers.
He told me, you know, I was the one that killed them dudes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
This is Empire on Blood, a story of murder, betrayal, and a man who fought the law for two decades, and of the confession that could set him free. I'm Steve Fishman. There is one thing that Dwight and Cal agree on. Prison is awful.
Same shit, same shit, same shit, same shit.
Same old shit, different tone.
Now, in a classic prison movie, Shawshank Redemption, maybe, one inmate comes to trust another. Their situation brings them together. They bond, take pleasure in friendship, pledge to help each other. But the prison life that Cal and Dwight described to me is not like that. Everyone is out for themselves. Friends are enemies waiting to happen. Hell is other inmates. Life is not interesting anymore. The routine is crushing. The stimuli so sparse, you barely feel alive. Dwight tells me repeatedly, I'm bored out of my skull. In prison, they say, do the time, don't let the time do you. Dwight isn't so good at that. He has a TV in his cell, enjoys Sudoku, loves to read John Grisham novels. Sometimes knuckleheads get into a fight and Dwight gets to spectate. That can be amusing. But mainly, he counts the days until his first board, his shot at parole. Cal, he's different. At one point, Cal creates a resume. The idea of a resume in prison, that seems pure fantasy. But, well, the resume is impressive. He's valedictorian of his GED program, earns 30 credits towards an associate's degree at Cornell. Cal's only job experience has been crack distribution. But under his resume's professional profile category, Cal writes, succeeds in a highly challenging work environment. My point is, Cal can imagine a life for himself outside of prison and inside prison, too. Cal starts a business. He gets married. More on that later. For now, consider how this encounter with Dwight changes everything. Cal and Dwight, former partners in the drug trade, former blood enemies, they are now friends.
You know, in a strange land where jail is not kumbaya. Jail is a dangerous place. And I know what you're about, you know what I'm about. We going through our issues, but in this situation, you having my back, I feel confident, and I know you feel confident having my back as far as this situation goes.
So Dwight promises to help Cal get out of prison. He confesses to the crime that Cal is convicted of. And Cal? Well, at first he's stunned. He'd always suspected that Dwight's brother Peter killed the Harris brothers.
You know, Peter was the guy that He was the gangster of the area. You know, Peter was the guy that shot at police. Peter was the guy that didn't have no problem with shooting at people that he had problems with. And that was Peter.
But if Dwight is going to take responsibility for the killings, well, great. Cal won't waste time puzzling out why Dwight would have committed the murders or why he is confessing to them now. Cal, as his resume notes, is a highly motivated, detail-oriented self-starter. And Cal gets started. He sends Dwight to a jailhouse lawyer who persuades him that his confession can not be used to convict him of the double murders. Dwight writes an affidavit saying he killed the Harris brothers in 1992. Cal is represented by legal aid lawyers this time. Based on Dwight's confession, they file an appeal, which makes its way to the DA's office. The appeal lands on the desk of Cal's nemesis, that's right, Alan Caron, Turtle Man, the prosecutor who had turned the hopeless case against Cal into a winner. If Dwight's confession sticks, Turtle Man's brilliant work, down the drain. Usually the DA's appeals bureau handles appeals, but Turtle Man volunteers to take the lead on this case again.
You never believe for a second that this is a real confession.
Absolutely not.
So Turtle Man is suspicious. I have questions too. Like, what inmate in his right mind would volunteer that he committed a double homicide? Dwight's not stupid. He has to know that his confession will expose him to all kinds of risk. So why in the world would he stand up and say, hey, I did it, even if he did do it? I've thought a lot about this. The Dwight I know is a complicated being, a convicted killer, yes, but also a person with a deep loyalty to his own self-interest, as well as a person in need of approval. Dwight feels things deeply. He cares what other people say. He once told me he hears Peter, his dead brother, whisper in his ear.
I always felt like, what would this dude say right now if he knew what I did? And it always put a chip on my shoulder.
What would he say? What would Peter say?
Honestly, he would have said, man, that ain't the way to handle that.
How's the way?
Violence. He would have said violence is the way to handle it.
Violence. That is how you handle your business. Not by snitching to the DA. Not by being a rat.
Deep down, I know he frowned upon that. So that always ate on that part of it always ate at me.
Peter would be ashamed of Dwight. And Dwight wants to make his brother proud. Yes, he'd snitched. Now he'd unsnitch. And then, in addition to Peter's praise, well, imagine praise, since, you know, Peter's dead. Dwight sees another benefit. Cal seems to like Dwight again, and Dwight has missed that. But the criminal justice system, not especially interested in Dwight's rekindled friendships.
I never believed for one second that he did it. There ain't no way in the world he's going to get up and say that he did do it, even if he did do it.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's different.
So I knew it was all bullshit.
Yeah.
And I knew what happened. I knew that he got pressured and, you know, he was forced. He's being forced to say this.
After the break, Turtle Man sends his right-hand man to see Dwight. His mission? Undo the unsnitching. We're back with Empire on Blood. Let's leave the grim prison world with its betrayals and fear and tedium. It's a beautiful day in New York. Let's get on a boat.
So this is the Bronx, huh?
It's beautiful. Have you ever sleep in
here? This is, as far as boats go, it's pretty high-end. This boat new, believe it or not. This is an 06, but this boat new is like 600,000 pounds.
Get out of here.
Yeah, expensive.
Get out of here.
I'm on a boat on a dock at City Island in the Bronx, just 5 miles from where Dwight and Cal sold crack back in the 90s. The boat belongs to retired police detective Frank Vigiano.
You like my boat?
I love your boat. It's fantastic. It's beautiful here, too, you know? It's so quiet. I mean, it's really not like here in the city.
Frank is in his 70s. He's short and slim, more Columbo than Van Damme. He served 4 decades in the New York City Police Department. I ask why he became a cop. He points across the East River to Throgsnick. That's where he grew up, a comfortable blue-collar section of the Bronx.
So we had like 30, 40 guys that we grew up with. And most of the guys went into the service. And when they came out, you know, there was a lot of openings for the fire and the police department. So everybody took the test just to take it. And I got called and you know, and I said, hey, this might be fun. You know?
Fun. Every cop must graduate from the police academy, the institution where the city of New York turns a young person into a cop. Frank's first day of school, it was cut short.
I remember people running around the academy that day saying, oh, Martin Luther King got killed. I mean, I was 21 years old. I was just out in the Marine Corps. I didn't even know who he was, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King, you know. Oh, yeah, big civil rights leader. Probably going to be riots now.
It's April 4th, 1968, and there are riots throughout New York City. The order comes from on high. All hands on deck. School's out. Frank and his classmates are taken to the firing range. It's dark. You can barely see the target. They fire off 50 rounds, and then they are sworn in and sent to the barricades.
That night, they gave us blue hats and the gray uniforms. Zero training. Zero.
Right.
And they sent me out to Bedford-Stuyvesant. I had never been out there. I don't even know if I had ever been to Brooklyn.
Here's what Frank remembers of that night. A long-haired Native American dude comes running by, chased by a group yelling that he stabbed somebody. In a minute, Frank has him on the ground. They're exchanging punches. Then something called the Tactical Patrol Force arrives.
So they respond first. And, you know, they literally pummel this guy to the ground. They throw him in a car. And they say to me, what the hell were you doing, you know? I was trying to open the handcuffs with the key. I didn't know you could push them through, you know, and that's how you open them. Now, I mean, how would I know that? You know what I mean? I never had a pair of handcuffs. I had no training.
In case you didn't pick up on it, that's delight in Frank's voice.
Oh, yeah, I loved it. Front row seat to the best show in town.
Years pass. Frank Vigiano rises through the ranks, becomes a detective in the Bronx. Then he gets the top investigative job at the DA's office. Frank strikes me as different from other cops. He doesn't like guns, doesn't believe in the death penalty. Turtleman says he's more cerebral than the average cop. Also, Frank, he's a people person.
I was nicknamed Father Frank by the Homicide Bureau supervisor.
Oh, is that right?
To get confessions. But again, you know, it's...
They do confess to you.
Yeah, I was pretty good at that. And, you know, that's just not that I'm that great, but you get guys that have a way sometimes with people. And
that's what makes Father Frank a formidable adversary for someone like Calvin Buari. Father knows how to talk to people like Dwight, how to get them to confess or unconfess. Without even talking to Dwight, Frank believes he knows how Dwight's confession happened. Cal threatened Dwight. This explanation is easy to understand. No psychological mumbo-jumbo. Prison is a dangerous place, and in Father Frank's estimation, Cal, he's very dangerous. Frank knows Cal's type. Cunning, ruthless, manipulative.
Most of these guys in jail, I mean, that's all they do is try to figure out how they're going to get out. You know, especially a guy like Calvin. He got, that's the only hope he has in life. He's there 50 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So what else does he have, you know?
Yeah.
Got old girlfriends on the outside, and, you know, he gets them working for him, doing shit, making sweatshirts for Calvin, you know, and he keeps writing letters to defense lawyers, trying to get people to take his case, and studying law books, and, you know,
In fact, Frank is exactly right. Cal has been doing all those things, and more, running a campaign from a prison payphone to keep his name and cause alive. He's recruited people on the outside, one ally in particular. Pamela Williams visits him in prison several times a week. Been doing that for a couple of years now.
So we get up to take a picture, and he get down and he was like, would you marry me? And
I he get down, excuse me?
One knee, yeah, he did it. And I was like, I thought he was joking. And he's like, I'm serious. And I was like, yeah.
Okay, I need to give you a little background here. When Calvin Buari entered prison in 1995 with a sentence of 50 years to life, he was despondent, angry, out of control. His future wife knows that.
When I came into his life, again, he didn't care. He didn't care. He had this attitude. He didn't care. He didn't care what happened to him. He didn't care what he did to anybody, because here he is convicted of something he really didn't do. He got all this time, so he didn't care. He really had that attitude, and he showed it a lot.
Cal spent a lot of time in the hole, in solitary. He was found guilty of reckless endangerment and promoting contraband. Yes, Cal dealt drugs in prison. Eventually, Cal got 3 more years tacked onto his sentence, 53 to life. Still, Pam sticks around. She drives for hours, stays overnight in hotels so she can see him several times a week. Several women have called me on Cal's behalf. They talked to me about Cal, how he listened to them, helped sort out their problems. And they showed their love too. They worked for Cal's cause. But Pam, she goes above and beyond. Pam was raised in the South Bronx, but she knew Cal's old neighborhood well, very well. Her aunt and uncle and cousins lived on East 213th Street, near the corner on Blood. Her first cousin sold crack for Cal and then testified against him. Given her connections, Cal had reason to be wary of Pam. But then...
And I came into lawsuit money, and I gave him some. And then some of it was hard-earned savings. And I, you know, I did that. I gave him money, and I...
How much money did you give him?
$20,000 at the time. It was for his freedom.
Wow.
It was really for his freedom. I didn't care. I just gave it. I gave it to him. Make sure that, you know, post-conviction is very expensive. To know that, and to know that, you know what? If you and I don't work out, at the end of the day, this is for you. For you, so that you don't need to depend on anybody else that comes behind me. Hmm. You know, and that's what I did.
What was his reaction?
I think that's when he said, I'm going to marry this woman.
Cal's mother had given her son some advice. Love the one who loves you. That way, she'll never leave you. Cal took her advice. Now, Pam is no slouch. Eventually, she'll earn a couple of master's degrees and land a big job in the healthcare industry. She's impressive. And as I sit in her large corner office and listen to her, I'm confused. You marry a guy who might never be able to go anywhere?
I didn't care. That's the funny thing. I didn't care. You know, we were still together. I told him I would have did the life with him. Like, I really, truly at that time loved him. I didn't think that far ahead. Mm. I lived in the moment. Mm. Why are you looking at me? He said, Yeah, I did. I really did. I don't have no regrets.
Prison marriages, they are not ordinary unions. No wedding planners, no flowers, no band. On her wedding day, Pam arrived at the prison with Cal's mother and brother.
What happened?
He got into trouble. And they said, you're not getting married today.
And what do you think?
I was pissed off. Because it was embarrassing. Your mother here, I'm here, your brother here, and... You know, they like no wedding today. He is actually being detained.
What had he done?
I don't know if it was drugs or weapon or fighting or arguing. I don't know. But I know that they just told me no wedding. That's what they told me. No wedding today.
Well, it's a tough ride home.
A very tough ride home. Mm-hmm.
Pam and Cal do manage to get married a few months later. And Cal discovers marriage has benefits. They have some conjugal visits. Cal can let his guard down, among other things. He and Pam go into business together. They start a fashion business. Catalogs of clothes they sell to inmates. Timberland chukkas among them. Pam funnels more money into Cal's cause, $50,000 all told. That's what she figures. Cal responds. He focuses, gets to work on his case. And all this happens before Dwight shows up in the mess hall at Clinton Correctional Facility. Dwight doesn't just sign a confession. He joins Cal's campaign. Once he was a super cooperator for the DA. Now he's a super cooperator for Cal. He tries to reach out to witnesses. The witnesses he once urged to testify against Cal. Now Dwight wants them to testify for Cal. In November 2003, Cal calls Pam. Not unusual. But this time, Cal says, somebody wants to talk to you, and he doesn't say who. The Department of Corrections records every phone call an inmate makes. This is the recording of that call, something I found in evidence.
It's Dwight.
Hi.
What's going on?
Nothing.
Yeah. Now, I made mistakes. I'm about to correct mine, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? This ain't a place for nobody, so I'm going to do what I got to do, you know?
Pam is now in a complicated position. She's the life partner of a man who may spend the rest of his life in prison. She's also the bridge between the outside and the inside. Now that Dwight and Cal have been reunited, Dwight wants Pam to reach out to her cousin and the others who testified against Cal.
Listen, let me explain something to you and your people that stand at the phone, okay? So if I do my part and nobody wants to give it up, that's them. They don't want to give it up. They don't want to be bothered. What part of they don't want to be bothered?
Pam is annoyed. Cal is always a handful, always demanding. But this particular phone call is different. Pam has not been running around telling the world that she and Cal are married. She may be in love with Mr. Cool for life, but she doesn't need everybody in her business.
As far as that, man, it's like this, man. Right now, my thing is this. I'm trying to help your husband.
Wait a minute, who said that was my husband?
That's what I'm saying.
Dwight isn't put off by Pam's reticence. He presses her to reach out to the witnesses.
I'm not going to stress nobody with a point, but somebody's going to say, I'm harassing him. You're threatening. Listen to me. If he tells them she's calling me because she involved with the dude that killed, they really not going to help.
Did you catch that? They're going to say, you're harassing, you're threatening. Pam's right. After all, the DA believes that even behind bars, Cal is a master manipulator. Cal does let those who testified against him know he hasn't forgotten them. He sends a couple of them birthday cards, which is kind of creepy.
Yo, man, I don't want to be standing out here and cold talking about this Lord night anyway, so I already know what I did was wrong. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to correct my mistakes. That's the bottom. The stones won't roll, y'all.
Yeah, well, it would be nice if the stones would roll with everybody come back. But you got to understand something. Everybody moved on and everybody's, not to be funny, they happy. You understand? If they like, they don't care. Y'all have to realize that not everybody cares. People are like, man, F that. They go back and they meditate and they're like, this nigga ain't worth it. I'm out. I'm not doing nothing. That's what they're going to do.
All right. Yo, listen, I'm going to put a card back on the phone, you
heard? Huh?
Put a card back on the phone, you heard?
Okay, well, it was nice talking to you.
Meanwhile, the DA's chief investigator, Father Frank, is on a mission. Undo what Dwight has done. Father Frank needs to sit down with Dwight. But first, he has to figure out how to keep that sit-down secret. That's after the break. We're back with the Empire on Blood. Back on the boat with Frank Vigiano, Father Frank remembers how hard it was to plan that sit-down with Dwight discreetly.
You gotta remember something. You're in jail, and you ain't there. Everybody wants to know, where are you? You get pulled out for something, why are you pulling him out?
Yeah.
You know. It'd be like, you know, you're home with your wife, and in the middle of the night you leave. Like, where the fuck are you going?
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm going out. You're going out? Where are you going? You know what I mean? That's the way it is. I mean, everybody, you know, you're in a routine there. You're in jail. So we made it look like we're looking at him for an old robbery or something. You can do a lineup with him.
So, with a little subterfuge, Frank gets Dwight in a room. Father Frank never yells, but in a quiet voice, he lets Dwight know, if you help Cal, you'll never go home. At least that's the message that Dwight takes away. We're going to deuce you for the rest of your life. Deuce, that means two. Dwight gets a shot at parole every 2 years after his minimum 25 is served. But if he helps Cal, the DA will deuce him every 2 years.
So at that point, I had something to think about. I never put that in the equation that they would low blow me like that.
So Dwight's alarmed, but Father Frank, he's not done yet. Now, the courtship phase.
It took a long time for me to win favor with him. I had to visit him a couple of times. Yeah, he wouldn't, he stood fast to what he was saying in the beginning, you know.
So what happened?
Well, I called his mother and I took a shot.
Father Frank called Dwight's mother, told her son had confessed to a double homicide, that he joined the Free Cal Movement.
In that community, from what my experience anyway, is a lot of these kids, their parents were West Indian immigrants and you know, hardworking people, and for the most part, decent people, you know. And that was the case with his mother.
Right. And what's his mother's role in it?
Well, of course, she was upset, you know, and she's concerned like any mother would be, you know, but, you know, very low-keyed and like, you know, accept the fact that her son's a bad kid and he's in jail and he did a murder and he's going to be there for the next 20, at that point, next 20 years, you know. She came to me once. I brought her there to talk to him.
Now, what was that like?
Well, he wasn't happy that I brought her, but I did, you know.
Well,
he refused to see me, which he has the right to do, but the correction guys brought him out anyway. You know, because technically, you know, you do have some rights in there, you know.
Dwight's mom is his strongest family connection. His only brother was shot dead. No one was arrested. But Cal had a hand in that, right? Dwight believes so. And so does his mother.
The next thing was, they went and told my mom what was going on. And she couldn't believe it. Like, wait a minute, you willing to help this guy that killed your brother? She let me know, if you help him, just live your life. We don't have nothing to do with you. So at that point, weighing all the options, it was like, you know what? This guy go home, turns his back on me. I'm in jail for the rest of the life. Guess what? With no family. Talk about a hard bit.
A hard bid. So Dwight faces a choice. Continue on his path and lose his mom and serve out the rest of his life in prison, or recant, double-cross Cal, reap the rewards, and live with the consequences.
Yeah, well, when I said to him, you know, we'll move you to another prison. I'll put you in any prison you want, I said. I'll put you somewhere close to home. I said, and we'll give you a new name. I said, we'll change your identity, which I could have done. He said, everybody I grew up with, everybody I know is in here. He said, ain't like you. Everybody you know is probably cops or firemen. He said, but everybody I know is in here. He said, you can't change my face.
Frank calls in a few favors, gets Dwight moved out of the prison population and into a special unit, a protective custody unit at another prison. For Cal, it's just like Dwight disappears. Prisoners are transferred all the time. And now Dwight, he's back on the DA's team, Frank and Turtle Man's team. The hearing on Cal's appeal begins in 2005. in the same courthouse where Cal was convicted 10 years earlier. This is the hearing in which Dwight was supposed to be the lead witness for Cal. Assistant DA Turtleman is, as usual, smart, aggressive, and in control. He calls Father Frank to the stand. Father Frank looks over at Cal.
Had him staring me through the whole testimony, you know. And, you know, well-dressed, very cool, you know, never just flatlined the whole time. But he's a cold, calculated killer.
Maybe Cal looked that way to Frank, but Cal, really, he's stunned. To him, it's like Turtleman has shifted reality. It's like he's taken the same set of facts and concocted an entirely different story from them. Those tender moments of camaraderie with Dwight, hey, that's my little brother there. In his testimony, Dwight now characterizes them as subtle and not so subtle displays of power, veiled threats. Why had Dwight confessed? He tells the judge, I knew if I didn't, you know, my life was in danger. And then on the stand, Dwight repeats the whopper. Cal's legal aid attorneys bring up Dwight's attempt to kill their client. And Dwight, straight-faced, responds, no, I didn't try to kill Cal, even though he's told Father Frank all about it. On Frank's boat, I'd confirm that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So has Dwight open about trying that he tried to kill Calvin?
Oh, yeah. He told me. He goes, it was my brother's fault, he said, that he ain't dead. He said, because he goes, he told me so.
So the authorities know, but nobody tells. Dwight gets away with the lie again. And not just any lie. The prosecution's lead witness tried to murder the defendant. Significant detail, I think. How can Dwight's perjury go unchallenged? Turtleman insists he personally didn't know that Dwight tried to murder Cal. Not during the first trial and not during the second hearing. But I have to wonder. Is this business as usual? No one tells the prosecutor? Do inconvenient facts get dropped from consideration? I went to the archives. I found a case with similar circumstances. It's the Bronx, 1998. Two teenagers are convicted of murder. Someone else confesses, but the Bronx DA discounts the confession, doesn't investigate. 13 years later, a federal judge writes, quote, the record contains a number of troubling indications that the prosecution was more intent on protecting a conviction than in seeing that justice was done, end quote. The judge sets the two men free. The prosecutor in the case, Alan Caron, Turtleman. In a previous episode, I had asked Turtleman about this kind of thing.
So never got reversed for anything?
Nope.
Maybe everyone's memory is faulty from time to time. And yet, Turtleman is kind of right. Okay, a judge did reverse one of his convictions, but that occurred inside a federal courtroom. It didn't affect Turtleman's career, his standing in the office, his annual raise. His boss stood behind him. The reversal? For Turtleman, it's like it didn't happen. And from what I can tell, that's the rule. Prosecutors don't get in trouble for this kind of thing. At Cal's hearing, Turtleman knows just how to handle the question of why Dwight would confess to something he now claims he didn't do. Dwight doesn't have to be threatened. He has to feel threatened. Remember when Cal and Dwight were in the yard together? Cal offered to protect Dwight? According to Dwight, he offered to slap the shit out of another inmate. Was Cal really offering help? Or was it a way to let Dwight know that Cal takes care of business? It's like those birthday cards Cal sent to the witnesses. Turtleman can tell you what their purpose is. Cal knows where you live. Even Pam, in this view, is one of Cal's enforcers. On a prison visit, she spots Dwight, offers him some food. Aha! Turtleman knows what that's really about, too. Harassing, threatening. He tells the judge, quote, it was in the nature of a clear threat, and the message was, As it was with all the other threats, we know who you are, we know where you are, and we can get you at any time. Cal's fate once again depends on one person, Dwight Robinson. Which Dwight should the judge believe? The Dwight who confessed to a horrible crime, or the Dwight who now says his confession was forced? The judge concludes Dwight is credible. The Dwight who felt threatened. The one who said the only reason he confessed is because he was afraid of Cal. And so, Turtle Man triumphs again. Cal's appeal is dismissed. The Dwight who snitched, unsnitched, and re-snitched is sent to protective custody. And Cal, he returns to prison to serve the remainder of his term.
I mean, it was a crushing blow.
Now, Cal doesn't really put the crushing in crushing blow. You just don't hear it in his voice. That's Cal. But Cal's wife, Pam, she sat in the courtroom as the ruling came down.
I was numb. I think I cried. I probably did. I didn't want to cry in front of him because then he'll be worried about me. But it was a blow because you're really thinking he's coming home.
So you're going to bring him home to the house?
Yeah, he was coming home.
One day when I do cry, man, it's going to be a floodgate that I can't stop, you know? Because I think that, you know, I am kind of like repressing a lot, you know? But, you know, this is how I stay strong. This is not a place where you can just let out your tears and not be looked at a certain way or be considered weak. But, you know, one day, you know, I know I'm going to have my day of just releasing all my tears. I think I'm just trying to hold on to my strength.
Cal will have to put off his tears. His first possible release date, 2048. Next time on Empire on Blood.
I stepped on the gray line, which you're supposed to be on one side of the gray line, and if you're on the other side of the gray line, you're evil or bad. I'm on the gray line.
The Bronx never forgets. I take a 12-hour train ride with a private eye who carries a gun and a Bible. We search for the missing witness. Yeah. Empire on Blood is produced by Emil Klein and Mia Lobel with Joelle Doucette. Our editor is Julia Barton. Original scoring by Joel St. Julian. Theme song by Mr. Len. Fact-checking by Stephanie Daniel. Special thanks to Jason Gambrell, Evan Viola, Christopher Landry, Rachel Strom, Nicole Bunces, Christy Mirabal, Kate Mescal, Lisa Firestein, Jacob Smith, Carly Migliori, and Andy Bowers at Panoply. I'm Steve Fishman. A kingdom built of blood leaves the king lonely. Bear the burdens of your sins and then only. Beware the blurred line between friend and foe. The last words you hear. It's time to go.